Okay, hello Radio Land, and welcome again to the Medical Freedom Show. This is your host, Heather Martin, and I am joined again by chronic pain patient and activist Tamara Stewart. Hi, Tamara.
Hi, thank you for having me again. I'm very much appreciated.
Thank you so much for being back. Tamara was on our last show, but didn't get to speak as much. You're part of a group, so I definitely want to bring you back and give you more of an opportunity to speak with me on the air. Just want to fill our radio listeners in that this is a very unusual and experimental show. We are still in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic. And because of that, I don't have access to the radio studio today, and I'm doing a show from home, and Tamara's been wonderful in helping me to experiment and troubleshoot with a lot of different technology. We're using Zoom right now, which I'm still a little new to, and please excuse our audio quality because I don't have my access to the equalizer and what I normally have to work with. So thank you for joining me on this unconventional and experimental broadcast of Medical Freedom. So Tamara, fill our listeners in a little bit about your background, those who may not have caught the show last month, and tell me, you know, how you became a chronic pain patient activist?
Basically, my medical background comes from two diagnoses with cancer. The first one was 10 years ago. Second one was 4.5 years ago. Both of them involved multiple surgeries, and all of it was pelvic. So all my surgeries, I think 13 total, just wow, in one spot. And it's created beyond measurable amounts of scar tissue. And that was on top of a autoimmune disorder with the connective tissue. They still haven't identified that one. Don't know what it is, but they know it's there and it's causing all kinds of problems. So on top of all of those other things, I have a bad back. I have other pelvic issues, and it just compiled to the point where no matter how much physical therapy or what I did, I still needed at least some level of long-term opioid therapy to be able to have the best life I could. Mm-hmm. And in 2018 here in Oklahoma, the law started changing and they were making restrictions, and the law was so confusing. None of the doctors knew how to handle it. So their solution was to just start reducing doses, regardless of whether it was going to be helpful or not. Regardless of the scenario or the patient, they had to start dropping doses because mm-hmm. they were afraid of the law.
Yep. Now, some of our listeners who hear a story like yours about dealing with chronic pain and having these injuries and recovering from cancer, you know, a lot of people are quick to say, well, try natural remedies, try yoga, try positive thinking. And while those things are beneficial in many ways, there really are times and situations where a person needs actual pain medicine. And when we talk about pain medicine, we're talking about natural medicine. We're talking about some of the oldest, most understood types of medicine that is out there. And because this is the sap of the poppy flower, the poppy bear, somifernum, and the sap creates opium and creates all of our opioid derivatives like the morphine, the oxycontin, the heroin, and so on. Heroin, which is very demonized, but has as much of a legitimate medical background as any other opiate-derived medicine. So was that part of your experience too? Did you try everything and find that?
Yeah. I still use a lot of it. I still mm-hmm. use mindfulness and meditation techniques. I still use guided imagery. I still use CBD. I right. still have PT, exercises, I had done all of that prior to adding the long-term opioid therapy, but so now I have a combination of all 25 modalities that I use on a daily, weekly basis.
Mm-hmm. And but I think that's true.
I think a lot of people don't think that, don't realize
yeah.
that.
Yeah, and it's true for a lot of people who suffer from chronic illnesses that they're using everything that they have available to them, anything that has a benefit or value, they're going to go to. And this is why so many people are still insisting that they need this opiate-based pain medicine, which now our system is trying to move away from. And it's very interesting right now, going back to this pandemic, because you know, there's been political forces urging pharmaceutical companies like to produce less, or in the case of fentanyl, to stop producing certain forms of the drug at all. And now that we're in a major health crisis, we have hospitals that don't have enough medicine to keep people in their medically induced comas for the intubation. It's just really horrific what's going on out there to the rest of the world.
It is.
Efforts that have been put in place to stop the production of opiates and to really capitalize on the ignorance and lack of understanding about what these substances are. That's another.
And I think a lot of us, when we have sent letters begging the DEA not to continue cutting, not to continue reducing supply, explaining to them that that's never worked. It didn't matter if it was prohibition in the 1920s
right.
or today. It still doesn't work. Let's try something that is evidence-based, that does work. But we've tried to beg them not to. We've tried to beg Congress not to. And we kept saying one major incident here or in the anywhere in the world, and the supply we have now is not going to be enough, even for the new injuries.
Right.
I don't know of any of us that haven't included that in at least one or 10 of our letters.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are. Now it's happening exactly like we said it would, just like in 2008, Dr. Alex DeLuca said it would. It's not like it's a new concept, yet it's happening and they are going to have to do something about it. Hopefully sooner rather than later, but I do hope other people around the nation start paying attention that this really is happening. And just because they didn't know about it before now doesn't mean others didn't recognize it and warn about it before now. Not yelling conspiracy theories. This is real life.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. speaking of conspiracy theories, but you know, what's been very obvious to me and all of this is that our nation, our criminal justice system, our police system has become dependent on drug prohibitions, on this war on drugs. Because if anything, it's been a cash cow. You know, it brings in the revenue of property seizures and keeps the flow of incarceration for the prison industries. You know, we have the highest per capita incarceration rate in the world. So you know that there's a benefit in this to certain people's pockets and why that pipeline is maintained. Now, the facts about cannabis, about marijuana, have been coming to light with such force that the truth could not be suppressed any longer. That's such a beneficial, helpful substance is being prohibited. The cause of this war on drugs. But without that, you know, what happens to our prison system and our police systems that, you know, have so much invested in this war on drugs? They need a new target. They need a new demonic drug. So it's just like the Reefer Madness movies where they said, you know, one puff of a joint and you'll become a lunatic. Now they're saying, well, one pill from your dentist, you'll be an addict for life. And you better not take that medicine when you break your arm or it'll mess you up, boy. You know, it's the same, the same propaganda, the same mind control, and it's feeding upon fear and ignorance.
It is. even in my own family. And I have explained to my family, my grandmother specifically, about that it is a lot of fear. And she says, yeah. Oh no, when I had my surgery, I took X, Y, Z. She listed 7 or 8 medicines that she took because she didn't want to take those opioid pills and get addicted.
Yeah.
But she forgets to mention she started hallucinating, fell out of bed, thought all these horrible things had happened to her. It wasn't because of the pill that she decided not to take. It was because of the 6 others she took to try to avoid the one pill that's been demonized so heavily. Can't right. convince her of that. It had to have been that they gave her something in the hospital the week before or something that caused that. But it's a side effect of all the other medicines that we're being told to use now.
Yeah. And a lot of the medicines that are being pushed in place of opioids, especially the way that they're abusing Tylenol, and I'm just going to come out and say, gosh. Abusing Tylenol, because yes. this is a substance that does cumulative liver damage. Cumulative means like the damage that's done never really recovers, and the more you do, the more damage you have. So Tylenol is something like you may really want to avoid, at least I do. I can't instruct anyone else, but myself, like I'm afraid to take a Tylenol. Just knowing what it does to the liver is scarier than drinking a lot of alcohol, which I also don't do, but you know, I wouldn't want to do that to myself.
You brought up another good point with the alcohol. You know, they make it sound like any pain patient who takes their medicine, takes it the right way, or somebody who gets injured is going to either addict instantly and or overdose instantly. Almost every one of the deaths from overdoses, whether it's legal or illegal drugs that they're blaming it on, doesn't really matter. They kind of put them all in the same category, lumping them together like the COVID-related death. That's where we're at. We have a lot of opioid-related deaths. Right. They had nothing to do with the doctor, but we'll go there another day. But those are usually involving alcohol. Now, if you go talk to any of the thousands of pain patients that I talk to or you talk to on a daily, weekly basis, we don't drink. Very, very, very few of us drink. And if we do, it's when we're taking our medicine. In other words, that's not us. That demographic that's overdosing is not the same as the pain patients who take their medicines correctly. Don't mix it with random illicit drugs or alcohol or take excessive amounts. That's not the same people.
Yeah.
I think that's what I wish the most people could understand.
Exactly. We've been seeing a lot of statistical skewing. you know, and also since the war on drugs has shifted from cannabis to opioids, there's been a lot of suicide related to pain patients who are cut off of their medicine, who are condemned to horrific suffering with no hope and no choice, or seemingly no choice. And those statistics, like when we heard of the skyrocketing veteran suicides, you know, even going back like 5 or 6 years ago when it was headline news, you know, these massive veteran suicides, what they were not telling in those stories is that's when the VA changed their policy that they would no longer give oral pain medicine, which means medicine that the patient can control, anything aside of a pump or a patch. So you had a lot of people with serious injuries who were given this torture sentence. We're cutting off your medicine. No more for you. Either you get this strange device to implant it in your body and deal with this kind of wound for the rest of your life. Or, you know, some people were on the patch, like someone I know, my partner, who was developing full body rashes. He's covered in red welts. And they said, oh, no, you're stabilized on this. No change. Like, you know, they just don't care. And when you're like, you know, coming in covered in red welts, obviously in pain and suffering, and they just tell you, no, it's policy, we're not going to help you.
Because that's not
encouraging to life. Yeah. Let's put it that way. But those those suicide statistics were counted as opioid deaths.
Oh, absolutely. I have no doubt they were. We found one that was counted as an opioid-related death. She was a passenger in a car that was hit by a drunk driver. She wasn't driving. Her driver wasn't even drinking. Somebody else hit them, but because she had opioid pain medication in her body, that got counted as an opioid-related death. Those are the types of statistics that are going against us. And for the veteran suicides, what was it? A few months ago, they had a study that came out, and they were all seemed shocked that increase in pain intensity equals increase in suicidal ideation and behavior. We did a 3-year study to learn that. And you know what? That's been out a few months now, and not one policy's been changed since then. Somehow now we have official studies proving when a veteran is denied pain medication and their pain level is intolerable and through the roof, and we don't do anything about it, that they have more suicidal ideation. We have proof now, even if that wasn't obvious enough, mm-hmm. and we're still not doing anything
common
about it.
Common sense.
None of this is common sense.
Yeah, I know.
I don't think common sense in the medical world, it seems. I think a lot are seeing that with today's COVID, all the different issues surrounding it, the people who are saying, no, you can't require me to stay home. No, you can't force me to do something against my will, my body, my choice. That keeps coming up. And I want to ask everybody.
Yeah, I know. What's that?
If it's my body, my choice, if that's their war cry and battle cry for all different movements, then why do they get to have any say in what I do in my body? It doesn't say my body, my choice, except when you disagree with me, then it's your body, my choice. It's everybody should be allowed to have their own choice for their own body of what they put in their, you know, how they handle their medical problems, whether it's with medicines, with natural cures, whatever. We should each have.
Exactly. We're actually almost out of time for this segment, but when we come back in the next segment, I really want to focus on that because I feel like this time is really important for the advancement of medical freedom. I think this is a great time to be having all of these dialogues. And yeah, it does come down to my body, my choice, and I feel like we're really going to be like, this is all going to come to a head very soon about, you know, where do we draw that line? Where is the distinction between us having freedom and autonomy about our own bodies or just complete totalitarianism? And, you know, it's a very interesting topic. And
if I have anything to say about it, it will come to a head about this. This is the time I think we can all get out there and really push and say, it's time for you to understand you want control over your body, then give me control over mine.
Right. Absolutely. It goes back to one of our founding fathers, Dr. Benjamin Rush, who when the whole Bill of Rights and Constitution, Declaration of Independence, all of that being put into place, you know, he said, we're making these provisions for religious freedom. We need a provision for medical freedom.
Yeah.
You know,
helped a lot.
Yeah, I don't think a time when slavery was still a thing was the time to start talking about self-ownership, right? I mean, that wasn't
not a
comfortable topic for people at that time. They were still invested in their peculiar institution. Okay, well, thank you for joining us. And this is Heather Martin from Medical Freedom. I've been speaking with Tamara Stewart, chronic pain patient and activist. Thank you again for being on our show.
Thank you for having me again.
Thank you. And hello, listeners. You are listening to Medical Freedom with Heather Martin on WGXC 90.7 FM. It's the radio station I am recording this for today. I'll leave a link to the station and the for my YouTube listeners. I'll leave a link to the station so you can tune into our radio show there and become a listener as well. Tamara, are you still with us?
I am.
Okay, she just dropped off. We're doing a kind of unconventional radio show today because I am working from home as a radio programmer. I don't have access to the studio and the equipment I usually use. So this is kind of experimental. We're recording over Zoom, so there will actually be a video to today's broadcast. There is a webpage for the Medical Freedom Show on Facebook. It's at facebook.com/Medical Freedom Radio Show. There I post links to the past shows and the show in all of its forms will be listed there. So please go and check out that page. Give us a like if you just want to show your support. So Tamara, in our last segment, we left off kind of talking about, we kind of got off the chronic pain topic a little bit because these times we're living in are just so momentous, so much is coming to a head, and we see how some of the problems that we've known about for a long time, the war on drugs, the impact on patients, the dwindling human rights that we seem to have when seeking medicine, this is all just kind of coming to this cresting tsunami with this coronavirus, because we're seeing not only the pandemic pandemonium, but now we have shortages of medicines in the hospitals due to the war on pain medicine. This is creating some really bad complications. Doctors don't have what they need to keep patients catatonic for intubation. They don't have what they need to treat the pain of their patients. And it's a really sad, really scary situation that we're in this now. And also there's just so much conflict really between like people who are staying home and trying to self-isolate or who are following the directives. And then there's people who are even going out now and protesting and literally getting up in arms. And while I actually kind of like seeing people getting up in arms and protesting, it's like, no, you're still not paying attention. You should have been doing this 12 years ago for pain medicine, not, you know, just trying to help out our neighbors right now. So I want to talk about that a little bit more, you know, just about what is medical freedom and why it's so important right now. And the thing that really scares me a lot, because I was injured by a vaccine. The last vaccine I had was an MMR vaccine. And shortly after the vaccine, I developed intense pain all throughout the vaccine area and eventually the whole left side of my body. And it's what's known as fibromyalgia, which doctors will say is a non-illness or psychological, but it seems to coincidentally happen to a lot of people after vaccines and seems to be vaccine related. So I'm fortunate that after a few years of the chronic pain of that, it just sort of left as quickly as it had come on. But I still get kind of like residual sensations, let's say, of that pain. Like I kind of know it's still there, even though it's not affecting me that way. But I would definitely be terrified of taking another vaccine.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, one of the things they're talking about now is it's like not releasing the quarantine until everybody has been mandatorily vaccinated, like repeat of the smallpox scenario where everyone of a generation has a scar from the smallpox vaccine. That scares me a lot, because while I don't mind working from home and wearing a mask in public and doing all of those things, I draw the line at having to take a dangerous substance into my own body. That's where
I think a lot of people should. Someone on Twitter said it best yesterday. It's a medical procedure. There is no other medical procedure that they don't give informed consent and that you have the right to say no to, with the exception of if you've been found incompetent or incapable of making your own decisions. So why is this, to me, any different? That's why I personally feel that this should be something that each has their own choice if they would like to get vaccinated. It is a medical procedure. It has risks, just like any other medical procedure. There is no way you can tell me that every person in America or across the world would understand the risks or would even be presented with the risks before they were told to take this. And whether the fear from about COVID and coronavirus, whether that is justified or not, whether it's that bad or not that bad, depending on who you ask, the ultimate, it comes down to, it still does have risks either way. And somebody's going to have to make that decision for themselves if it's worth the risk or not. I don't like the idea of somebody else requiring me to. Will I get it? That's maybe, I guess. I don't know yet. But do I like somebody telling me I don't have a choice or I can't go back to school or work without that and a special card that tells me or an app on my phone that tells everybody I'm okay? No, that's more stigma than we already have. And pain patients already know all about stigma and how that works. So we don't need that. Nobody needs that.
Exactly. I had a guest on my show a while back, and she was a mother of two children who were injured by vaccines. And she came from a background of being a nurse. So here's somebody who came from being a true believer in vaccines and science to just seeing what was happening with her own children and the horrific injuries. And it just, you know, screaming everything to her senses, like, no, there's a problem here, that this is doing damage. And just like, you know, she shared her story about just the fight she had with everybody in the medical community, was trying to downplay what she's observing. And, you know, we were talking earlier in the show about the statistical skewing of deaths, like how many deaths were attributed to opioids, but were not actually caused by the opioids. And we're hearing about this happening again with the coronavirus, that people are dying for other reasons, but it's getting labeled as a COVID-19 death. And that's just, it shows that there is something inherently unscientific happening in our scientific community. And I think this should be a cause for great alarm. My guest who had the two injured children told me that she found out far after the fact that there was a test that could have been done on her children that would have shown that they had, I don't know if you call it a mitochondrial deficiency, but like less mitochondria than the average person or something like that. There was a mitochondrial issue there that predisposed them to vaccine injury. Okay, so why isn't every child tested for this before they're vaccinated? Why should any child be injured when a test that exists could have prevented that? You know, and this
is why,
to me, it's so very unscientific. There's no follow-up being done with the vaccines. They're encouraging now, like the HPV vaccine is for an STD that's not really going to be applicable until the person becomes sexually active. But they want to give this vaccine to the infant. You know why? An infant can't explain how they feel.
True.
An infant can't describe their symptoms. So they're trying to get more vaccines put into pre-verbal people who cannot describe what's going on, who cannot give feedback. And, you know, that's just another way to hide the effects, is by giving it to such young children.
I have kind of a theory backing up just a few seconds to what you said about something unscientific happening in our scientific community. So we all know that as opioids increased, you know, as the opioid deaths increased, funding increased, which then the CDC sent out something telling coroners and medical examiners around the country how to label the death appropriately as opioid related. Well, that happened again with COVID-19. The CDC sent out guidance of how these deaths need to be classified, and how even if you just think it was pneumonia or flu or COVID and you don't have a test, go ahead and label it as a COVID death. And that's how, I assume, that's how the numbers are going to get high enough for there to be extra funding and justify it. So I actually went back and I looked right around the time that the CDC looked at or started talking more about heart disease. Now understand, I'm not saying any of these aren't real. I'm not saying any of these issues don't exist and need to be treated. But when the CDC started talking about heart disease, the funding started increasing. Guess what? There is a CDC guidance about how to do that. Shortly thereafter that guidance came out, the death rate skyrocketed, just like they did with the opioid related and with the COVID related. And you know what? Just right after that happened, the funding expanded even more. So it's kind of like we see the problem, we put a little money on it, the CDC guides them to tell them how to change the numbers or, you know, skew the death slightly, maybe a whole lot. And then all of a sudden the funding comes flowing. And of course there's motivation to continue showing that all of these deaths are opioid or COVID or whatever related. I haven't had a chance to check out others that may be three isolated incidences, or it could be exactly how it works every time. I don't know yet. Something kind of dawned on me the other night while I was thinking about what to talk to you today about.
Yeah, and you know what else is interesting to me, speaking about all the non-science that's going on in our scientific world right now, it seems like doctors really have their hands tied when it comes to practicing medicine. I mean, we know that they have had their hands tied when it comes to prescribing the opioids because of the CDC, the DEA, all these regulatory agencies that don't have a medical degree or anything or don't have chronic illness, so we're telling them how to prescribe. But it just boggles my mind, some of the things I'm hearing about regarding the coronavirus pandemic. One of them, I was made aware of a doctor in my state, New York, Dr. Cameron Kyle Sedell. And I've been watching some of his YouTube videos, and he's talking about how the coronavirus is not like respiratory infections that he's used to dealing with, that the symptoms seem very different. He's dubious as whether the ventilator protocol is the right way to go about treating the patients. He feels that the settings are too high, that's actually doing damage to the tissue in the lungs, that they're putting people on these ventilators at a set protocol. And I could see some other theories about how to better treat it, like maybe increasing the oxygen mixture. Now he's going out on YouTube and making these videos and talking about it. I'm like, wait a minute, he's a doctor. Why does he have to go to YouTube to talk about this? Why can't he be in that hospital saying, wait, this doesn't seem to be working. Let me try something else. Now, you know, his hands are apparently tied. He's got to apply a blanket protocol to everybody that's exactly the same. You know, why can't he be making decisions? Why can't he be experimenting with the patient's permission? You know, if doctors were allowed to do this, we would be having medical breakthroughs on the fly.
Oh, absolutely. Speaking again of that, did you see where Kaiser Permanente sent a letter out to all of their lupus patients saying, we know that you get your hydroxychloroquine, I can't pronounce it, HCQ, and we are going to stop you from receiving that medicine and use evidence-based treatments to find you a new treatment so that we can use that medicine on COVID patients. So they stopped one actual evidence-based treatment for a well-established disease in order to save the medicine for a experimental treatment that nobody had even known for sure if it was going to do any good or bad yet. On top of that, they use the words evidence-based. I think that is the part that bothered me the most. They told the lupus patients they would find them another treatment using evidence-based medicine. And all I could think was, then why are you ripping away the evidence-based medicine to throw it at an unknown? And you know what? Both, I don't care if they use it on COVID and lupus. Great, try it. If it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. That should absolutely be between each patient and the doctor.
Yeah.
You know, if the doctor's comfortable with it, if the patient wants to try it, so be it. If not, do not kick every lupus patient off of it, calling it evidence-based to show, to send it out to other people.
One of my Facebook friends shared an excerpt from a similar letter that they were taking her off of her medicine and actually said, we thank you for your sacrifice.
Yes.
Was in there, and she was really outraged, you know, like,
yes,
I didn't sign up to be sacrificed, you know.
Like I said, I was just astounded that them using the words evidence-based when they're talking about using that medicine for COVID just blew my, and they weren't saying that that was what was evidence-based. They were saying they'd find the lupus patients a new treatment using the evidence-based, but apparently they don't believe in evidence-based, or they wouldn't have done that. Same with when they deny our medicine. If they were going off of evidence,
well, then your evidence
sure
is anecdotal.
Treated well.
It doesn't count, even though it's
exactly
evidence. Right. Yeah, exactly. It also boggles my mind why the president's thoughts or opinions on medicine should have anything to do with the availability of medicine or how it's being used in the hospitals.
They shouldn't. Whether he said it or didn't, I mean, I know he said it, but they shouldn't have, that should have not guided anybody or anything.
Exactly. He should be able to think whatever he wants, you know?
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. Love him or hate him, I don't care. I'm somewhere in the
middle.
That's
not his department.
Doesn't really matter. The truth is, he has free speech, too. He has the right to say and think whatever he wants to.
Exactly.
Just like I do, just like you do. And you know what? Nobody has to go do what he says as far as when he's throwing out suggestions and ideas. Nobody should. It should be between you and your doctor, period. There should be nobody else involved, whether it's COVID, whether it's bleach, whether it's whatever. It should be you and your doctor, period. Including the insurance companies, they need to leave too, because they're using cost-cutting measures and anything but evidence-based. They grab one little thing that they claim is evidence and throw out years of medical science. Like you said, we know what opioids are. We've had them for how many thousands of years? There is evidence there. So throwing those out the window is grabbing some new propaganda-based evidence instead. It's not real evidence-based.
Exactly. Yeah, the evidence is being thrown away, and just the due diligence and the protocols that you would expect from scientists are not being followed at all. And that's just a really scary situation to me. It boggles my mind. One of the things that medical freedom means to me, I know I pack a lot of into those two words, but it is that practitioners of medicine are allowed to practice that medicine to the best of their knowledge, abilities, and conscience, and not be controlled by any government or regulatory big brother agency. I mean, you know,
there you go with common sense again.
Yeah, there I go. Common sense.
I know. You can't have that when you're talking about medicine. It is no longer allowed.
Yeah, and that's really scary, because that's where it's needed the most, when it's a life and death situation. All right, we're at the end of our second segment. thank you, Tamara, again, for being on my show, and thank you to all of our listeners for listening or tuning in. Okay, we're going to come right back with the Medical Freedom Show. This is your host, Heather Martin. I'm speaking with Tamara Stewart today, chronic pain patient and activist. And it seems like we are still going on the Zoom chat, so we're just going to keep with it, I guess, until it bounces us off. And if that happens, we'll go back to Facebook to finish up. This is an unconventional radio broadcast as I'm working from home and trying to muddle together these different technologies to do an interview with Tamara, who's in Oklahoma. So thank you for digitally coming all this way, Tamara.
Well, thank you for understanding. You said something about working from home. You guys can't see what's around me, but I kicked out the kids who were doing their schoolwork on the Chase Lounge with the chalkboard behind us, and all the stuff we have all over. The schedules are all lined up around here. I've got, so that's just, we're all doing what we have to do to make it work. And this is what we do right now. I have three of them that are trying to figure this out, all different ages. So,
wow.
It's fun.
It's a lot. Yeah, we're just dealing with this pandemic, and it's really making our times very interesting in many ways, and especially in terms of medical freedom, because the issues of medical freedom are really coming to a head. You know, there's all this talk about forced mandatory vaccination, as we were talking previously. I've been injured by a vaccine myself. Some of the guests on my show have talked about their own vaccine injuries. Vaccine injury is very, very real. And I am not anti-vaccine. I am pro-vaccine choice. I would like to see more science turning toward the vaccines to make them safer, to make them more effective. Going back to that guest on my show who had the two injured children, she also told me how she had a titer done on her children years after their vaccines. A titer is a blood test that will show if you have antibodies. If you've had a vaccine, a titer will show if your vaccine is effective, if you are protected against that contagion. And her children showed no antibodies.
Wow.
And, you know, anybody who's ever been titered for a vaccine, it seems like if vaccines are mandatory at a certain age, the titer should be kind of like part of that. You know, shouldn't there be some follow-up to see if they're effective? They're forcing these mandated vaccines, but then they're not even providing people the protections that they're supposed to.
So you would think, again, with the common sense, at some point, there's going to have to be something that happens to allow common sense to come back into medicine. Like you said, if they're going to, whether they require it or just really strongly urge a vaccine, maybe they ought to spend a few years, like you said, doing the titers, doing the testing, doing something. Because I would imagine people like me who, like you said, I'm pro-choice. I'm not against them. My kids are vaccinated. But I also have had some questions, and I've stopped and slowed back down and wanted to ask about this latest HPV. I guess we're just kind of in the middle, maybe. Mm-hmm. I should be able to make that choice. Goes back to my body, my choice, or my child, my choice. And that should be something common sense follows. And my point is, I'd imagine if there was true studies that said when we vaccinate X number of people, 5 years later, this many of them are still protected 100% with one, however many injuries overall. Mm-hmm. If that evidence was out there, real evidence, not just somebody stood up and said something and they expected us to believe it. But if that was out there, I think a lot of parents, especially like me, would fall into the other side. We would quit questioning.
Yeah.
But right now, and especially since I've learned so much about this opioid crisis, how it came to be and what they're trying to do and how they're capitalizing on it or COVID. The more I learn, the more upset I am of how many years I have just allowed to be convinced of whatever somebody wanted to believe me to believe in medicine. I have just followed because I thought you're supposed to believe what the CDC or, HHS, FDA, I thought you were supposed to believe them. I did not know it was money driven. Maybe even more than money, power, and politics. Mm-hmm. I think I'm just disgusted. And that's how common sense got taken out of medicine, period. They allowed money and politics to rule the day. So common sense can't be used anymore.
Right. And it's know a lot of the big corporations just getting so big. You have these corporations that are dedicated just to research. So they have taken that ability away from doctors. So now doctors can't try new things on a patient and follow their instincts and follow their training. I mean, doctors should be the front line of the research as well as everything, because they're the ones who are working with the patients. Those research facilities should just be, you know, taking some of that feedback from the doctors and trying to develop it further for what the doctors don't have time to do. But right now it seems like the doctors are just given a blanket protocol. This disease, do X, and it's expected to work exactly the same for every patient. And human bodies are not exactly the same. We're all very unique individuals that require individual care and attention. And when you have big corporations running everything like a computer, the humanity is just removed. And yeah,
it is.
We don't have a sense factor.
There you go. And if that corporation or research company happens to be funded by somebody who has stake in a predetermined outcome, for some reason, when there is a desirable outcome, it almost always makes the mark. They will selectively choose who to include, who not to include. Going back to the twisted statistics, they will literally decide what to include to make sure that whatever they wanted the outcome to be gets it. And we've seen some evidence of some really poor studies that it doesn't take a medical mind or a research mind to look and say, well, if you took out everybody who's ever benefited from whatever medicine and then tested it on the rest, of course you're going to get a lesser result. You know, it doesn't take much. So they are constantly finding ways to make sure their research fits the need. And that's where the so-called selected outcomes come into play. If the selected outcome is that people don't die, of course it looks like it's a success. But they're forgetting to mention all the other side effects or whatever it is, I guess. That's just an example.
Yeah. I've, for a long time, thought that all the scientific journals should be publicly accessible.
Agreed.
Because you can, you know, when I was in college, I had access to scientific journals. And let me tell you, I spent a lot of time in them. I was poring over a lot of stuff when I had access in there. And one of the things is there's not a whole lot of quality control in these things. Like if you kind of read between the lines, you can see kind of how skewed and unscientific the so-called study would be. Like, I don't think this would have passed by my third grade science teacher if I tried to put that together, you know. Also, like the rodent studies, when you have animals that are kept in a completely unnatural environment, they're under duress. They're already in some bizarro experiment and none of their reactions are going to be normal. It's interesting.
Same with all of it.
Yeah.
Picking like and choosing what to take out of a medical.
The studies for the opioid war were based on these very skewed animal studies where they had rats in cages with absolutely nothing going on around them, just terrified in a cage alone, and they would give them access to an opioid and they would just hit it till they overdosed. But then another scientist came up with the idea of putting them in a social environment where they're running around with other rats and put out the opiates from them. And they still hit them occasionally, but nobody sat there and overdosed on it. Wasn't their interest. They had other things to do. And, you know, it reflects a lot on our society. You know, we're talking a bit about overdoses in the first segment. And, you know, we have just like a lot of pain, a lot of deep nihilism that people develop through being just beat down and running up against brick wall after brick wall after brick wall in their lives. And really, if we want to talk about having a mentally healthier society, we should really talk about reducing all those small regulations that are barriers to opportunity. Like, let's cut down on your lawnmower boy needing $40,000 of insurance every year just to operate. You know, let's do something about that so that young people can go out and be productive and take their initiative and better themselves. We instead are putting up all these barriers and wondering why the next generation just can't function and falls down and resorts
exactly. to. Exactly. Well, and you touched on it earlier, though, too, the cash cow. If you were to remove all those regulations and there was somebody having to buy that insurance and the permits, oh my gosh, where I live, we have to buy a permit to remove something that is a fence that is against our house. We have to pay a permit fee to remove a section of fence that was never supposed to be there. We have to then get a permit fee to, you know, on and on. I can't even describe to you how many permits we're going to have to pull just to add one bedroom and put a fence around my backyard. So if you take away those regulations, you also take away their funding, their finance. You know, that's money coming in for every one of those. Same with, like you said, the insurance. Now that insurance company won't be lobbying for those regulations because they're not going to be making any money. That's where it all comes from. The insurance company wants to make more money. They go and lobby and beg them to make more regulations. It's a circle. It's no different than the CDC and the overdose model circles. It's all money driven. They have to find ways to increase money regardless of who suffers because of it.
Yeah. And that's the real crux of it. You know, we've got so many things to fix in our country and our system, and it kind of all has to come together, really. You know, it's not like you can really separate out one part. So I'm thinking of like how it is with the doctors and these regulatory agencies and these research and development firms, you know, that are all working together to tell doctors how to operate. You know, recently I was involved in discussion about like the big stores and Walmart and stuff. And a lot of people like blame Walmart for shutting out a lot of small businesses. Like in my area now, you know, they're pretty much the only place to go to for certain things, like certain kinds of toilet paper. And we used to have more stores and we don't anymore. But I want to just say, you know, it's not just Walmart, but also the distribution companies and the producers are as much at fault for the move towards the big box stores as anyone. Because distributors, major companies, like say Kodak or Fuji, for example. When I was a kid, I used to send them a letter and one of my parents' checks in the mail, and they'd send me film for my old camera. I had an old camera and I couldn't get film for it in the stores anymore. So I started just buying my film direct from them. Some years later, that became just basically unheard of. None of these big companies would work with individuals. They will only sell to a distribution company. And then like I was talking to a small store owner one time, going back many years ago, one of our old stores, and he was telling me how it was becoming impossible for him to keep merchandise in his stores because they were setting the minimum orders higher and higher and higher to the point like, you know, you'd have to like buy hammers, but it would be enough hammers to fill the whole building, not, you know, just what he needs for his hammer section. So
all money and power.
Yeah.
And I'm not against people making money. Everybody has to find a way to make money. I'm not saying that, you know, that's not how it works. It is. I don't know how, because I don't want to expect people to not make money over public, you know, the public good. There's just not a good answer there. And so I guess that's why we are where we are.
Right. And I also think, you know, it's beyond the capitalism, socialism dichotomy that people seem to be caught in, that there's only two ways for a society to operate. Some say that we're just living in capitalism, but this doesn't really seem like a true capitalism. Like to me, true capitalism would be Kodak selling film to me. And maybe if I bought a bigger order, I could start a little store and sell film for older cameras, you know, and so on. You know, I could build on that. That to me is like a true capitalist kind of society, but when you get into all this collusion, when you get into these corporations having personage and having power, it's that's where it gets a little skewed. If you look at our historical documents, a corporation is supposed to only exist if they can show a public benefit.
Right.
You know, and they're the only ones who legally can be taxed of their profits. You know, not individual income, but corporate profits are constitutionally taxable. And you have a lot of corporations who are paying zero taxes, you know, like Amazon. And so something is really wrong here. And I wouldn't just, you know, point the finger and say, oh, it's capitalism, because we've got something. There's actually a word for this. When you have government and power getting involved with business, that's called fascism. It gets confused a lot with the racist genocidal aspect of fascism that kind of comes with it somehow. But that's really what that's about, is when you have government controlling the business. Like you have the DEA telling your doctor that they can't give you pain medicine. Like, yeah, that's not a laissez-faire.
That shouldn't be allowed. That's what we keep going back to, this, that the my body, my choice. You know, one of the things I'm working on is helping. I want to make a parallel thing. It's called a parallelism, I guess is the word for it, of all the different things that I wish everybody could see, because people are seeing the COVID and they're seeing how all these companies are capitalizing on it. Then they're seeing how the government is controlling and stepping in between. They're seeing all these little parts that you and I have wished for so long, and every other patient, that, you know, was common knowledge to everybody else, because then they would understand what we've been saying all this time. So right. I want to really put it together as a, you know, like, I guess I kind of said it earlier, my body, my choice. Until you disagree with me, then, you know, I'm going to choose for you. And that shouldn't be that way, whether it's the government, the insurance, nobody. And I think that we're going to have to find a way, like you said, medical freedom encompasses so much. And we're going to have to find a way to put it all together. And
it might just change our whole
big uprising. Society. That is my plan. I think there's a lot of us that feel like COVID is a horrible, horrible thing, but that we are going to have to take this opportunity to show those parallels and use that to explain how we can go forward from here, not just for pain patients, but for everybody.
Exactly.
But we will have to be included in this conversation, because we actually have been through this.
You know, I came into doing the show because of seeing what my partner, was a chronic pain patient, was going through. But I had this epiphany and I said, you know, the people who are wanting choice for abortion, the people who want a say in vaccine, we're all fighting for the same thing. We all want the same thing. So I'm trying to go beyond the chronic pain community to just try to reach the whole community, because everybody's got a vested interest in this on some level and somewhere. Tamara, thank you so much for being on my show. Time has flew by again. We have a minute left to our radio segment. The Zoom seems to still be going, so we might be able to go a little bit past this, but we'll only have an hour to fit in on WGXC.
Right.
So I want to again thank our radio listeners for tuning in to us today and listening to our unconventional little broadcast from my home. And hope you are all staying safe and well. Thank you so much. Thank you, Tamara.
Bye. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.